Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. So glad to have all of you with us for our show today. Let me make a couple of announcements, because every now and then I forget until about 35, 40 minutes into the show to do this. Number one, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and we love hearing your reading your tweets. We want to know what you're thinking as we go through our conversation. And if you just are dying to see what we're all doing sitting here in the radio studio, you can watch us on Facebook Live. We have our top radio engineer, Lane Starrett, in there running Facebook Live for us today. Lane, thank you for doing that. So go to the GPB page on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB news page on Facebook, and you'll see our show unfolding live, and you can leave comments there, too. So, that said, Greg Bluestein, it's Wednesday. It's your day to join us.
We're glad.
One of our favorite days, too, is having you here. Political reporter for the AJC, also a contributor to the Political Insider blog at myajc.com, part of Politically Georgia. And you were dominating the newspaper today, Bluestein.
Yesterday was a busy day. We had profiles, we had vetoes, we had news of a state investigation into voting in City Hall. So lots of stuff.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you've set the agenda for this show personally, single-handedly. Julianne Thompson, a Republican strategist and operative in Republican Party politics for a good number of years. We'll leave it at that. How about that, Julianne?
Sounds good.
Thanks for being here. Dr. Andre Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University. We're always glad to see you as well.
Glad to be here.
And Eric Tannenblatt. Thank you for coming back and joining us. Eric has been a longtime Republican leader in Georgia and across the country. He did a lot of work for both the Bushes, for Mitt Romney in his presidential bid. Are you helping out with the Romney Utah Senate race?
I'm supporting him.
Yeah. You doing more than that? Are you raising money for him?
I'm doing my part.
Okay. Eric Tannenblatt also just got a big promotion. You don't mind if we tell people that, do you? You're at Denton's, the world's largest law firm. And now you're like their global government relations head or something?
The head of the global chair for public policy and regulation.
Going to have to get you a bigger chair when you're in the studio. Right.
You want to switch?
Just means more work.
I got it. Thanks for being here. All right, let's go right to it. I do want to start out with a late breaking story, and we don't have to get into a discussion about it because there's not much to say. The news reached us maybe an hour or so ago that Andy Young was up in Nashville to give a speech. He took a fall, and he was sent to Vanderbilt University Hospital. Now he's coming back to Atlanta, and he's going to be admitted to Emory for at least a couple of days. His offices are actually on the third floor of this building, and I went up to see to express my condolences. I'm sorry to hear what's going on. They're saying to us right now, he's just testing. They're going to see what happened. Anybody have any more information on that, Greg?
Well, no, it just says a lot that he was still going around speaking.
At his 86 years old?
Yeah. So I think that's a testament to his health before the fall.
So, Andy, if you're listening to the show today, we send out our best wishes for a speedy recovery to you. Okay. Greg, one of the stories you had in today's paper was Nathan Deal yesterday reached the final day for taking action on the bills that had been passed by the General Assembly. We should start with a headline, 21 vetoes. That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, this is the most vetoes he's ever issued in his last year of eight as governor. And he usually issues about eight or nine. In 2016, there were 16 vetoes, including campus, gun bill, and religious liberty. But some of these vetoes were meant to send a statement, and we can get into that a little bit later. But the biggest non-veto involved Stockbridge, which was allowing basically voters to carve out a separate city of Eagles Landing, de-annexing a part of Stockbridge and creating a new city of Eagles Landing, which would be the first time this has ever happened in Georgia.
So it would set a precedent if, in fact, a court – there will be almost certainly, Julianne, a court challenge – to this, whether or not it's legal for residents of a city to essentially de-annex themselves.
Right. And I think it also sets a precedent for a lot of other areas in Georgia that are talking about doing the same thing. The city of Sharon Springs comes to mind in Forsyth County, parts of Cumming that want to form a new city with parts of Forsyth County that are not annexed. So we'll see what happens.
Andra, one of the concerns about this from the very start has been that there is a racial component to this and an income component to this.
Yeah, I mean, so part of the issue with this particular incorporation fight is that Henry County is undergoing tremendous demographic change. And so it becomes a question of whether or not the dissatisfaction with government has to do with sort of the changing face of leadership there. You know, this is an issue that came up in Fulton and in DeKalb County as well. We don't have evidence yet to test that. As an academic, that's the question that I'm most interested in terms of what exactly are the underlying motivations behind this. But I think there's also actually this other question of Stockbridge, like the part of Stockbridge that they want to de-annex is actually the tax base.
Mm-hmm.
And so you create this town, and then you end up bankrupting the existing town. And there's this larger question of Stockbridge has debt. And so who assumes which part of that debt, you know, should, you know, the citizens vote to pass the city? So I think there are a lot of things that still haven't quite been thought through. We have to figure out sort of like what the effects of this are going to be long term.
Yeah, we do have to point that out, Eric Tannenblad. There is the residents are going to have to vote on this in November. This isn't a done deal. This bill authorizes them to cast ballots to determine whether they want Eagles Landing to separate from Stockbridge.
And it wouldn't surprise me if there were legal challenges because of the, you know, the bonds that you're referencing. And that could impact the upcoming election, too. I just don't know the timing of it all.
The mayor of Stockbridge, Anthony Ford, said yesterday to several media outlets, this is not over. You know, this is far from over. He's openly said that they were pursuing litigation. They were preparing for litigation if the governor signed this. So, it's reasonable to assume there'll be a lot of there'll be at least one legal challenge.
So if this moves forward and if, again, a legal challenge comes up, but I already can see the next session of the General Assembly, based on what you're saying, Julianne, I can see these municipalities, people in these various cities lining up to get similar legislation passed in some of the areas that you were talking about. This could become a very major precedent that would change the map of Georgia in pretty significant ways. You know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, from time to time, people have talked about Buckhead, you know, pulling out of the city of Atlanta. That will not happen. As a member of the Buckhead Coalition, I could tell you that there's not a lot of support for that. But I think you'll start seeing, you know, people talking about that.
And these are becoming questions for State House and Senate members that are running for re-election. These are becoming questions in their debates throughout the state of Georgia. This came up, like I mentioned, the city of Sharon Springs, that came up as a debate question for the House district debate in Forsyth County. So I think it's a question that is going to be coming up throughout the state.
And if something like this were to happen, I mean, so far in North DeKalb and North Fulton counties, we haven't seen there be a problem with taxation. Taxes didn't go up sort of as a result of these things. But if you keep this kind of thing up, I mean, and right now it's still illegal to try to create separate school districts. But, you know, I wrote a book about politics in New Jersey, in Newark in particular, but just spending a lot of time in New Jersey, where you've got all those small cities and towns and boroughs, and you've got all those separate school systems, like eventually this could end up being a problem. So all the autonomy that people want could actually end up coming back to bite them in the long run. Yeah.
And that might be why, I mean, a couple hours after he signed the bill, the governor sent out a statement saying, A, he didn't believe that the debt issue involving Stockbridge would affect the state's overall AAA credit bond rating. But he also called on lawmakers next year after he's gone to formulate some sort of broader plan to deal with this annexation. The Democrats instantly called that a cop out, said, you know, an outgoing governor saying the next guy should pick up the slack on this was a cop out, and they're furious that he signed this yesterday.
All right, let's look at a couple of the other bills because we'll watch how that progresses in the months ahead. Greg, the internet sales tax, the governor signed that bill, and I think I'm right when I say it would apply to online sales for companies that have earnings of $250,000 or more. We know that Amazon is already supposed to be complying with a Georgia statute on adding sales tax. And I think the statute exists, but companies aren't complying with it. They're not collecting sales tax. Do I have that right?
Yeah, this was meant to encourage more enforcement. And it was also part of the broader debate about the tax cut, the income tax cut, because, again, state officials who are looking at the impact of the federal tax cut also hope that this these types of bills will increase the sales tax collections and help lawmakers give more tax relief down the road.
Okay, but it does mean, presumably, that if I start doing business on any number, or if I'm doing business on any number of online sales sites, I may be paying a bit more in the months ahead. Although there are court cases still, this has to be adjudicated mm-hmm. in a number of courts, I think, across the country before anything really happens, yeah?
Yeah, the one thing we keep on hearing from online retailers is they want some sort of national standard that isn't there yet.
Okay. Julianne, here's the one that I'm really looking forward to talking with all of you about, because the governor, he vetoed Senate Bill 357, little bill that would create a special health council, would create a director of that counseling. It's an 18-member body passed by a big margin mm-hmm. in the Senate and obviously passed the House as well. And here's why we love talking about this bill. This was Casey Cagle's baby. He was out there running on this bill because this was one of the ways he thought he was going to address the opioid crisis. What is going on here? Is the governor taking a slap at Cagle?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I think that, as I remember correctly, there was quite a debate on the floor of the House when it came to this bill, and a lot of accusations that this bill was being created with certain people in mind to head it up as sort of a health czar. So to have this bill vetoed, I think, changes a lot of things in the minds of people and some of the elections that could be going on as a result of who they thought was going to take that particular position.
Well, don't talk code to us. What does that mean?
Well, it was said that this position was created for Renee Unnerman.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. Senator Unnerman.
One of Cagle's top allies.
Yes, who is one of Cagle's top allies and who is a very, very qualified health professional.
Sure. This
has been in the healthcare industry for many years. And so I know that there was a lot of talk about if Cagle became governor and she became this health czar, that would open up her Senate seat. So I think that it changes a lot of dynamics. However, she's very well qualified and she's very close to the lieutenant governor. So I'm sure that there's going to be a different place for her.
Were kind of shaking. Am I being too cynical to assume that this is a little the governor kind of tweaking? You know, he and the lieutenant governor have not always had the best relationship. They do okay together. He opens his veto message on this with SB 357, while well-intentioned, creates several unnecessary additional levels of government. Am I reading too much into this?
Yeah, I think this is all. I'm not interested in getting into the palace intrigue. I think it is more about we don't need more government, and we have government agencies, and you know perhaps there's someone in an existing government agency that can be put into a role to do what this person was going to do or what this body was going to do. Now, we're going to elect a new governor. It may very well be Casey Cagle. He could take an existing position in government and do what he wanted this new healthcare council to do, or he could advocate for creating it in the next legislative session.
Well, Greg, Eric doesn't like palace intrigue, but we thrive on palace intrigue. What do you think?
And I think there's a little bit of that to it. I mean, this would be an 18-member council and a new position that would kind of operate outside the governor's office of planning and budget. I think that was a concern that was cited in the veto statement. But also, I mean, as the veto statement said, governors basically, you can do this, just not on my watch. Whoever's the next next governor will be able to encourage this legislation and assign someone to be the director of health policy or whatever the position called for. He just wants to wait till next year. I asked Casey Cagle's office about that, and they said, we agree with the second part of the governor's message that, you know, we will be pursuing this next year, essentially.
Do you want to weigh in, Andra?
No, I mean, I think that's my question. I mean, even if this does get vetoed, if Casey Cagle becomes governor, and if it passes, you know, this legislature easily, you know, assuming that the partisan sort of balance stays roughly similar,
yeah.
You know, which I know Democrats aren't hoping for, but like then it gets through again, he signs it into law, so it's just delayed by a year.
And Director Unnerman.
And I think that, let me just add that I think that Eric is actually speaking on behalf of a lot of the conservative base. I've been hearing his sentiments all around that we don't need another level of government here. And so I think that the governor's veto there has been widely accepted.
And there is a lot of overlap. There's the Department of Public Health, Department of Community Health. There is overlap there that he cited too.
Okay, well, we'll see what the next governor, whoever that may be, chooses to do with this legislation. Very quickly, the other big issue that came up in terms of whether the governor was going to sign or not was SB 315, which is the bill which would establish this new cybersecurity statute, which would prevent what they call white hat hackers from going in to test systems to make sure that it, to determine whether they are or not secure. It was a white hat hacker who found out that the voting data that was stored at Kennesaw State, the state voting records, were being hacked into. And that was considered presumably a good thing that you have that ability to test. This bill would have outlawed that. Governor vetoed it.
Yeah, this is why a lot of cybersecurity experts and Google and Microsoft raised alarms about it, because they think that these cybersecurity hackers all over the nation who sometimes go in and probe websites to see where there might be vulnerabilities and then alert the website managers of those vulnerabilities, they want that to continue, and they fear that this will be an unintended consequence of the legislation.
So those are the top line bills that I paid attention to. Am I missing anything, Greg? We covered the big ones?
Well, there's one more that's kind of interesting. Marty Harbin, state senator, after he got pulled over by a police officer in Tyrone, Georgia, for having an expired tag, and he was alerted that he might have to that his car could be impounded because of that. He said, "Well, I'm going to see if I can pass a piece of legislation about this." He did. Saying that essentially you could get your car back if you prove that you have a decal at any time got your tag back at any time since your arrest or your citation. The governor vetoed that, saying that there already is a way to get your vehicle back, but you have to prove that you had applied for your tag before the citation, not after it. So he says it basically weakened the state law.
This is what happens when legislators want to make law based on personal experiences with particularly law enforcement. Julianne, you want to weigh in?
I just wanted to add that Marcy's Law was signed by Governor Deal yesterday.
Tell everybody what it is.
I will. And it will go on the ballot in November. It is an initiative that passed the state Senate 50-4, passed the state House unanimously, and was signed by Governor Deal yesterday. It will take what is currently in statute with regard to rights for crime victims and elevate it to a constitutional level. It's a constitutional amendment. Georgia's only one of 13 states that doesn't have any constitutional protection for victims of crime. And what this does, as I said, is it takes what's already in statute and elevates it to a constitutional
level. What's already in statute? What would it do?
It would give basic rights to crime victims, like the right to testify before the judge before sentencing, the right to know when a perpetrator is getting out on bail, the right to know when a convicted criminal is coming up for parole so that the family or the victim could testify before the parole board. They're basic rights.
It is controversial in some ways, I think. There have been people who are not sure that we really need this protection. But you're confident that that it'll be on the ballot and people will be able to vote on it themselves.
It will be on the ballot in November, and it's polling very, very high across party lines.
Okay, let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. There's some interesting stories to talk about in terms of the governor's race. We are now less than 2 weeks away from the election, which is hard to imagine. Early voting is underway. Underwhelming response in terms of early voting. But we'll get to that after we take our first break of the show. This is Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start. And by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Eric Tannenblatt, Dr. Andre Gillespie, Julianne Thompson, and Greg Bluestein in the studio with me today. Greg, it's interesting that both you and Galloway, Jim Galloway, had stories yesterday that talked about guns in the Republican primary and how important a role they are playing. Your story addressed the fact that Casey Cagle, of course, won the endorsement of the NRA and boasted of that, as in a Republican primary you would. But Georgia Carey, which is, how do you characterize them as more conservative than the
NRA? I guess they're even more
the
stridently strident advocates of Second Amendment rights.
And what did they do?
Well, they endorsed, they said they strongly opposed the candidacy of Hunter Hill and they endorsed Brian Kemp.
Yeah, this is an interesting story, and I'll ask all of you to weigh in on it. Because, so, first of all, they did say they think Brian Kemp is their man. Remember, Brian Kemp had that TV commercial which showed him pointing a gun in the direction of a young teenager, allegedly a suitor of his daughter's, although it's clearly a young actor, which is fine. And so Georgia Carey, they said that's the kind of message they want to get across. Hunter Hill, who made what many Republicans, Eric, say was a mistake after Parkland, made the comment that raised the age of gun carrying ownership to 21, backed away very quickly. But Georgia Carey says, if you're really a supporter of the Second Amendment, you do not make that mistake. Don't vote for that guy.
Yeah, well, look, this is all about creating energy and trying to turn out voters in the Republican primary. And the gun issue is an important issue to a strong portion of the electorate, and I would say probably one of the more energized portions of the Republican primary electorate. And that's why, you know, they're all fighting for these voters.
Andre, this is a primary issue.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the general on guns?
So, I think the challenge or the risk for Brian Kemp is, I think everybody knows he's a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I think, you know, if this is your issue, then you're going to support him or oppose him one way or the other. But if he wins the primary and becomes the general election candidate, I think the question that he's going to have to ask is his strong support of guns and his strong articulation of that and the manner in which he's done it, is that going to pose a problem for him in the general election when you're trying to hit sort of a more centrist voter, particularly a suburban white woman in North Metro Atlanta? Is she going to look at that ad with the gun in the direction of the teenager and think that might be a bridge too far and maybe I'll stay home or maybe I'll go vote for, you know, one of the Democratic women, whichever one of them ends up making it into the general election? I mean, I think while I totally understand and I totally get why he's taken this strong stance, not only because he believes it, but because it plays well with this really small Republican primary base that's going to be smaller than the normal sort of your average Republican base in the state. This could potentially pose a problem for him in a general election.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if that's the only issue that people in the general election are going to focus on, I could see your point. But when we get into the general election, there's going to be a whole host of issues that voters are going to have to make a decision. And if you look at the two Democratic candidates, regardless of which one, they are so misaligned with the values of Georgia voters that, or the majority of values of Georgia voters, that I don't think that's going to matter.
Well, I think I disagree with you. I think we're all still debating sort of who the median voter is in the state of Georgia. And then I agree with you that it's not just this particular issue, but it's a question of sort of how does that issue line up with other issues? And I think it does actually raise a question about temperament. So, I mean, we may talk about this later. If you're in West Virginia and, you know, you are aligned with Don Blankenship, but like he tries to deliver a message that the president can deliver, but that he can't, is Brian Kemp in the same position where trying to be Trumpier than Trump actually backfires on you?
I think that 90% of the people that saw this commercial knew it was a joke. And I think that these same suburban women have their husbands holding a gun, photobombing pictures of their daughter with their boyfriend at prom. I mean, I see that on Facebook all the time. I think people know that Brian Kemp's commercial was lighthearted and it was a joke. So I don't think anybody is holding that against him except the left. With regard to Georgia Carey, first of all, I don't know anyone that doesn't think that Hunter Hill is a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I think that with regard to the comment that he made that you mentioned, there was also an additional comment that they cited where he said about open carry that he believed that only the military and police officers need to be open carrying. And that's what another issue that Georgia Kerry was holding against him. I think the vast majority of people that know Hunter Hill know that he is very conservative and a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment. But I do not underestimate the power of Georgia Kerry, because they made all the difference in the world when it came to the runoff between Nathan Deal and Karen Handel.
Well, so let me ask about that, and then I want to get you in here, Greg. You just raised a question that I need to figure out. Is Georgia Kerry have more weight for Georgia conservative voters than the NRA? In other words, how do you balance those two endorsements, one for Kegel, the other for—
Well, I think one's a national organization, and then Georgia Kerry is very state-focused.
Okay, but so they can mobilize voters within the state.
And they have meetings around the state of Georgia, so their members have a lot more ownership in the elections, I think, than the NRA members, because they're very actively involved and they mobilize at the state capitol. They will show up. They will work the rope lines. So they do have a lot of influence.
And there are a lot of NRA members that are Georgia Kerry members.
That's right.
There's a lot of
overlap. That's right.
Yeah. I will say this sort of wrinkle for the general election. We haven't had Democratic candidates who put guns on the table to show a contrast, really, in the past few election cycles. And this year we will, no matter who the Democratic nominee was, they will still be calling very vocally for gun restrictions to try to portray a contrast with whoever the Republican is. So that will be interesting to see if it's Brian Kemp, if it's Casey Cagle, if it's Hunter Hill, whoever it might be, how they react to that, if they make guns more into a general election issue, because there just hasn't had to have a guns as a general election issue in years past.
Greg, Julianne thinks that TV viewers will realize that Brian Kemp's commercial was supposed to be funny, but of course it carried a serious message. And in fact, you told us when we walked into the studio, we hadn't had time to see it ourselves yet, that he's doubled down with a brand new commercial.
Yeah, this one features more guns, an explosion, a chainsaw, a pickup truck. And each image in one image, he's saying, I'm going to take a chainsaw to regulations, and I'm going to explode government bureaucracy, and I'm going to fight for Second Amendment rights. And in the pickup truck, it shows him sitting in his pickup truck and saying, you know, I'm going to round up illegal aliens with this pickup truck if I have to. I'm going to say this because I'm a true conservative. I'm not afraid to say it. So, you know, that last ad and probably this one too, has given him exactly what he wanted, which was earned, you know, free media attention, without having to spend the big bucks. And he put $1 million behind these two ads. So he's got some money behind them. But you know, all the quote unquote liberal outrage and all the national media attention is really exactly what he wants in these closing days.
Well, this is a race for number two. Mm-hmm. Who is going to be in the runoff with Casey Cagle? And then it's a different race. And right now you have a battle going on between Hunter Hill and Brian Kemp. And this is a way for him to distinguish himself.
Yeah. Let me talk about that first. And then I want to get something, ask you a question under it. So we're beginning to hear the two of you, I think, Eric and Greg, were saying that although the last polling, public polling by the AJC was showing that Brian Kemp was kind of languishing, that Hunter Hill seemed to be in a better position.
Well, it showed them in a statistical tie, right. Even the last one, too, 9 and 10.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I apologize. Okay. But is there a surge for Brian Kemp, do we think?
I think these last ads have, or at least the one that I saw, I hadn't seen the new one, I think that has helped him. I think they're still probably within the margin of error, but I think Brian is starting to pick up a bit.
All right, here's what I wanted to ask you, Andre. You know, we've spent so much time talking about guns that it is interesting that the other showcase issue that Brian Kemp is really featuring, and it's in this ad that Greg just talked about, is his plan for getting tough on undocumented residents. And that's another issue that will serve him well in a primary campaign, but could prove somewhat troubling, I think, in a general election.
I'm not sure much about that one.
Okay.
You know, I still would be concerned. I have to watch the ad to see sort of like what the tone looks like. And so it's sort of the statewide equivalent of, is that the person whose finger you want on the button type of situation, which, you know, may not matter. But at least as far as dealing with immigration, Casey Cagle has an ad. I'm trying to remember trying to remember which of the two between Hill and Tippins is also mentioned undocumented immigrants in their ad. Some of the lower ticket races have mentioned undocumented immigrants in the context of sex trafficking. So that, I think, is sort of more of a standard garden variety red meat issue.
Yeah, but Brian Kemp's rhetoric has been way, way over the top compared to the others, I think.
And this is what he says in that ad that I misquoted earlier, which was, I got a big truck just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take him home myself. Then he closes his door and says, yep, I just said that. So he's really driving that message home.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I'm not quite sure, especially for conservative voters, if they're going to see much difference between that and the images that are in Casey Cagle's ads, where you have, you know, gang members, you know, supposing to signify MS-13. So, I mean, I think people will view that in the same way. So I don't view him as being distinct in that way because there are other candidates who are talking about this issue, too.
Julianne, Brian Kemp would be sorry to hear that Andre doesn't see him as distinct. He's doing everything he can, as Eric points out, to single himself out.
I think he's been strong on that. I think all of the candidates, like Andre said, I think they've all been pretty strong on that. Casey certainly has. And I think both Tippins and Hill have mentioned, although they haven't dedicated specific commercials to that single issue, they've both mentioned it. So I think that they all know who they're playing to at this point in time, and it's the Republican base. And I think Brian is working hard to turn out a lot more rural voters in Georgia because he knows that a lot of the metro area is trending toward Casey.
All right. You mentioned Clay Tippins. There seems to be kind of conventional wisdom right now, and polling suggests that Clay Tippins, who's a businessman, is trying to run the David Perdue-style race. I'm an outsider, and I'm going to come in and clean up government. There seems to be a suggestion he hasn't gained the traction that he, of course, would like to have. But I want to play his newest commercial because I think it tells us something about how he believes he needs to close out his race. Remember that he caused Greg a real stir when he ran a spot that attacked his opponents, but particularly went after Hunter Hill, calling him Benedict Arnold. Because of Hunter's comment about maybe we should raise the legal gun ownership to 21. And that really, really, he did not get the kind of attention for that, say, Brian Kemp did for holding a kid with having a gun held toward a kid.
Yeah, there's a broad consensus among Republicans that it backfired.
Yeah.
That calling an Army Airborne Ranger a traitor because of a gun position is not the way to go.
So with that in mind, I want to play you the audio of a very soft focus, lovely commercial that Clay Tippins people are choosing to close out the campaign with.
I always wanted to be a Navy SEAL. It mattered. And I took that same unconventional problem solving and whatever it takes attitude and built businesses around the world. Now it's time we bring that same skill set to Georgia's self-serving politicians to clean up corruption, transform and shrink government, cut taxes, crush sex trafficking, and get our kids reading. I can do that. Stand with me. It matters.
Andre, we're used to hearing that commercials flipped in order. It's the early spots in which we hear the positive message with the beautiful music, and then the attacks come later. But apparently, I think Fred Davis, the famous Republican commercial producer, I think they realize they went too far and they have to pull back.
So, well, I would actually argue I learned when I worked in Washington that it's more of a sandwich. So you do sort of positive bio, then you attack, then you clean it up at the end.
Yep.
So, and so I think, you know, we missed the first piece of bread and then the second one like didn't work. I mean, I think probably the thing that's probably most damning against Clay Tippins based on where we think he is right now in the numbers is that Hunter Hill's response ad, the one where it has some sort of, you know, on the Army sort of like a Colt Ranger sort of, you know, exercise field where the caricatures are of Casey Cagle and of Brian Kemp, and Clay Tippins is nowhere to be found in there when he's responding to, like, gonna call me tough? I'm tough. See, these guys can do anything.
I think the challenge for a candidate like Clay, who happens to be a very nice guy, is that he was unknown. And so you have to introduce yourself, but then you also have to distinguish yourself from your opponents. And the problem is all that takes resources. And the advantage that someone that Casey Cagle had and Brian Kemp is they had statewide name ID. So in the case of Clay Tippins, he had so much that he had to do to just get his name up that it was hard to do both.
He's unknown, and he also doesn't have the mega. He's a millionaire, but he doesn't have the mega millions that it costs to do that. He couldn't self-finance his campaign to the degree that other outsider candidates in Georgia have in the past.
And he didn't have a cousin who had been governor.
No, right. But he had one that had served in the Senate. But I think that the name that he made for himself was a very negative one. You don't call as a Navy SEAL. As a member of the armed forces, you do not call a fellow member of the armed forces, an Army Ranger that served three tours of duty in Afghanistan and has two Bronze Stars, a Benedict Arnold.
So I want to ask you a question, and I ask you because you opened the door for it, not because I think you will defend this, but I do think it's a reasonable question. That didn't seem to create a problem when campaigner Donald Trump told an audience that he thinks heroes are people who are not captured, not people like John McCain who are. What's the difference?
Well, I think one of the major differences is that Clay Tippins is characterizing himself as a member of the armed forces. And this is an accusation that he is making against a fellow member of the military. And I think it hurt him, and it hurt him big. And if he wanted a political future in the state of Georgia, he took the wrong advice by running that commercial.
How do you read that?
You know, I think it's all wrong. I thought what President Trump said about Senator McCain was horrible at the time that he said it. And I think the same thing applies here. I think Julianne is right. It really is kind of weird when you have one veteran maligning another veteran. That might actually compound the problem here. But I also think what's horrible here, and it's not just been done here. I mean, you know, there have been former police officers who have been characterized in races as being soft on crime and other kinds of things. It's just really risky and perhaps not the wisest thing in the world to take something about somebody's identity that's so well known and then actually try to use it for political fodder when it just actually doesn't match up with their background.
Well, and it's also hard to attack someone when you don't have your own base yet. People didn't know him, so
that's
they were.
Donald Trump difference.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
So they were introduced to him with a negative ad.
Well, that's why I made the point that we typically, early in a cycle, we see the positive spot. Here's who I am. I love my children. My wife is the most wonderful. Her husband, the best thing that ever happened to me. That's the way you introduce yourself. Not...
Well, he did have that Super Bowl ad early on. It didn't air
true.
That long.
Yeah, but there wasn't enough money put behind that, to really reinforce it.
All right,
it.
Let me...
real quick.
Sure, go ahead.
I will just emphasize that we're still so... I mean, there's only 2 weeks left, but there's so low turnout in these races that even, it could be 15%, 16% to get to that second runoff spot. So at least at the AJC, we're not counting anyone totally out yet.
And I think that's a very good point. I mean, look at David Perdue when he won that or got into the primary runoff in the Senate race. I mean, people were surprised at the turnout, and there were a lot of people that turned out to vote for him in that primary that people didn't really think were out there.
All right, before we go to a break, Ted Cruz just endorsed Hunter Hill. Does that have value in a Republican primary in Georgia?
Look, just like we were talking about the gun issue, I mean, Ted Cruz is very well liked and received and respected by some Republican primary voters. So in certain
Georgia.
In Georgia. And so you wouldn't seek an endorsement and publicize an endorsement like that if you didn't think it would matter. So he's made a calculated, decision there.
He'll be on his campaign literature. He might be in an ad. I don't know. And he might come here for a campaign stop, which would guarantee media attention. So
and then if Hunter Hill wins the election, he can go to Texas and try and help Ted Cruz, who is apparently having a little bit of a challenge.
We've been getting a lot of notes. Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of notes coming in from people on Twitter and on Facebook Live. Kevin takes issue with your comment, Julianne. Threatening someone with a gun is always funny, although I also believe it's a felony, says Kevin. Kyle Hayes, who runs a blog called Peach Pod and, in fact, is going to be a panelist for the first time on our show on Friday, says, can the Democratic candidate control the narrative enough to make the race about guns or any other issue where the Republican has taken extreme positions? Seems like the general may be a fight over whether Democratic or Republican issues get more attention. Andra?
So, I mean, I think the challenge in this cycle is how to distinguish this race from the president. And I think it just takes a lot of initiative, and I'm not sure either party has gotten a handle on how to define themselves apart from the president.
You know what, though? In Georgia, people are happy. If you look at, if people think Georgia's going in the right direction. If Casey Cagle is the nominee as the lieutenant governor for all these years, he was part of the group that's been leading the state. He's going to be able to make that argument.
Yeah.
And not just Casey. I think any of the Republicans, because the Republicans have been in the majority for, you know, since 2002.
All right. Let me get to a break. But I will say on Facebook Live, we have people who've signed in and said, listening in Austin. I'm here in Roswell. I'm in Savannah, Carrollton, Calhoun. People watching on Facebook Live from all over the state. If you want to join them, go to the GPB news page on Facebook. Let's get a break out of the way, and we'll be right back with more.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss EPA head Scott Pruitt, who's currently the subject of 11 investigations. Our guest will be New York Times reporter Eric Lipton, who's read thousands of EPA-related documents released through the Freedom of Information Act. Lipton first covered Pruitt when he was Oklahoma Attorney General and sued the EPA many times. Join us.
Fresh Air, today at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Let's talk. We've talked a lot about Republican gubernatorial primary. Let's talk about the Democrats for a few minutes. Greg, Stacey Evans has, in attempting to close a gap that the AJC poll shows she has with Stacey Abrams, mm-hmm. despite 50% undecided, she's now really embracing very publicly casino gambling, with the revenues, a good portion of the revenues, being earmarked for Hope scholarships.
Yeah, this is a new wrinkle on the Hope fight. We've heard about the Hope scholarship since Abrams and Evans got in the race, and the core argument that Evans has made is that Abrams betrayed Democrats and Hope scholars in 2011 by siding with Republicans on the deal that that cut awards for the Hope scholarship. And by the way, Abrams says that by doing that, she staved off deeper cuts that Republicans wanted. But now the new wrinkle is that Evans is saying she's an aggressive supporter of casino gambling in order to fund a needs-based scholarship. So the Hope Scholarship is now merit-based. You have to have a B average to get it. But a needs-based scholarship that wouldn't just go to scholars who have students who have a B average, but also those who show that they have financial need for it. And so that's a big sort of closing argument for her, and one that Stacey Abrams has pushed back on aggressively, saying that she was never opposed to casino gambling. But that she always wanted that tied to a needs-based scholarship, but she would pursue different ways in order to fund a needs-based scholarship, such as more aggressive budget cuts and a collection of sales taxes and things like that.
All right, here's my toss-up question. Anybody want to respond, go ahead and do it. Is this a good move on her part, and is it an issue that could attract a number of voters for her?
So one of the things that's actually been really interesting about watching Stacey Evans' campaign is that I've been watching her sort of morph into the second coming of Zell Miller. And so just the whole idea that she was going to set this up, you know, it harkens back to, and it wasn't that I lived here at the time, but, you know, reading sort of Zell Miller versus Andy Young in 1990. And, you know, this has more traction when you're coming up with it for the first time, as opposed to saying that I support this. So this wrinkle, I see her kind of putting her own stamp on it, which is interesting. And I also think that's interesting in the last week that she actually released an attack ad, because I was actually really skeptical about how much traction she was going to get by just actually inserting Hope into biographical ads. Like, I didn't think that was actually going to get that far. So I'm like, okay, so, all right, she's making herself a contender in this race. I'm not quite sure that casino gambling is going to have the same pop now that the lottery had in 1990, especially when we've seen casinos pop up everywhere in the country. I'm not 100% sure that it works in the same way. And then it's a question of, for Democratic primary voters, how much do you take advantage of the fact that you can try to penalize Stacey Abrams for the fact that she held a leadership position, which is why she's getting dinged on this, right? So anybody who would have been the minority leader at the time would have forged a compromise that could have been used against them when they ran for office.
So, Julianne, let's flip around the gun question. If Stacey Evans becomes the nominee, is the issue of casinos in Georgia toxic enough for a large enough percentage of conservative Republicans to hurt her in a general election campaign?
I don't think so. I think it's toxic in the primary, but I think in the general election, and then going back to what you talked about, those suburban moms, there's a lot of support out there for casino gambling. I mean, I'm not making a statement one way or another about how I feel about it. I'm just saying there's a lot of support out there for it.
Especially if you tie it to education and the Hope, funding the Hope Scholarship.
That's right.
Remember, there was a GOP ballot question in 2012 that showed a narrow majority of Republican voters backed casino gambling as long as it was tied to higher education. Yeah. And polls have showed a broader general election support for it. But as you mentioned, all five Republican candidates in the primary have all come out against casino gambling.
Yeah. All right. So you cautioned us quite correctly, Greg, that with 2 weeks left and with a lot of voters undecided, we really shouldn't make too many predictions about who's going to win the Republican or who's going to be in the runoff on the Republican side. We can certainly make that statement about the Democrats, although Stacey Abrams is way out in front in your polling. And although there does seem to be a certain kind of momentum around her campaign, especially because it's a campaign of destiny in some ways, with 50% of the voters undecided just a couple weeks ago, that really would give me a lot of sleepless nights as a candidate in that race.
And just and really low early voter turnout. None of us have seen the latest numbers, but the numbers from last week were well below, were well off from 2016's primary, which is to be expected. But not the numbers that a candidate, any candidate who's basing their campaign on mobilizing voters through grassroots means to go to the polls want to see.
All right, let me turn to another subject as we start to get short on time. You had the byline on the big story today. The Secretary of State's office is launching an investigation into the runoff campaign for mayor of Atlanta, in which Keisha Bottoms won by a very slim margin over Mary Norwood. What's this all about?
Yeah, that was an 821 vote victory. And remember, in that election and even in the 2009 election between Mayor Reed and Mary Norwood, there were accusations of voting irregularities and tactics and underhanded scheming and all this sort of thing to help Reed. And they've been unfounded. There's never been any proof or any formal report on them. But we now have confirmation from the Secretary of State's office that it is looking into more irregularities from that election, and these would be serious enough for them to look into it. We understand they're involving absentee ballots. We've talked to a few people who have leveled complaints about absentee ballots, being able to vote with an absentee ballot in November and not being given the ballot in December. So it might touch on that, but it also might go a little
bit
different.
Eric, the Secretary of State's office, certified this election clearly, or else she wouldn't have been, Keisha Bottoms wouldn't have taken office. And even in Greg's article, he makes the point, quotes some official, that it's unlikely to change the outcome of the election. Keisha Bottoms is likely to still be mayor of Atlanta, although they might find some irregularities that could deserve further investigation.
Yeah, and this just becomes a distraction. Let's put the elections behind us. Obviously, if there were things that went wrong, you need to learn from them to make sure that they don't happen in the future. Now, that's barring some other, shoe that's going to drop that we're unaware of. And as, if you live in Atlanta or read the Atlanta paper or see the Atlanta press, there seem to be shoes dropping every day.
All right. We'll watch that unfold. Andra, one more issue before we have to say goodbye, and we'll do this fairly quickly. We had primary elections last night, obviously, in a number of states. And the one that everybody was watching, of course, was in West Virginia, where Don Blankenship, a convicted felon, was on the ballot to run in the Republican primary for United States Senate. He lost by a large margin. But the one that really captured a lot of attention overnight was Robert Pittenger in North Carolina, a Republican incumbent who lost. He became the first incumbent House member to lose in a primary in 2018. He conceded to a minister, I think his name's Mark Harris, who had run against him once before and lost. And he was one of, I think, three Republican incumbents who lost in this cycle.
Well, I mean, this is a slightly different cycle than what people talk about when they talk about whether or not this is going to be a wave election. So when it's an intra-party fight, a primary fight, then it's an ideological fight that's going on here. So this is going to be very different than if, say, this candidate ends up losing in the general election to a Democrat, or if a Republican incumbent who wins their primary ends up losing to a Democratic incumbent. I think we have to wait to see. So I know everybody is paying attention to the tea leaves and the reelect numbers. You know, I follow the lead of my colleagues who do these types of modeling. They're not going to make those predictions till the summer. And so the variation that we see right now, one is a lot of noise, and then two, just, you know, give it another month or two, and then that's when I actually start to pay attention to whether or not this portends a wave.
Julianne, your take on that?
But we also saw common sense prevail in West Virginia with the defeat of Blankenship. So I don't, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. Of course, there is a big anti-incumbent fervor right now across the nation. But I think that people are having a lot more common sense when it comes to realizing they need to pick the best candidate to go up against the Democrats in November.
I was also watching the Ohio Democratic primary for governor, where you had progressive Richard Cordray versus uber progressive Dennis Kucinich.
Oh, well, wait a second. It's hard to compare Kucinich's left-wing status with Cordray. I mean, Kucinich is out on another planet.
With Bashar Assad, but that was a Democratic shift away from the sort of far-left
That's exactly
flag.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was also interesting that two other House members lost the Senate primary in Indiana to an outsider. So I think their loss, coupled with the North Carolina loss, says something to House incumbents, and I think that that's something to look at. One of the things that's not on your agenda that we hadn't mentioned that I think was a big story this week and was sort of pushed under the rug was the Attorney General of New York. Mm-hmm. who resigned, who was really a very vocal anti-Trump, anti-business, abusing women.
Yeah.
He was on Samantha Bee. She touted him as the savior for the whole Me Too movement.
As literally a superhero. Right.
Yeah. Eric Schneiderman. I'm not sure that the Kellyanne Conway did the president or the White House any favors when she tweeted, "Gotcha," in response to Eric Schneiderman's stepping down.
But that shouldn't take away from what he did.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's horrendous what we're learning about him.
I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, reminding people to be consistent in their personal lives and in their public statements. And so, you know, I mean, it's a shame. I mean, a lot of people, Democrats, are looking at this as saying, look, will they address this issue immediately? So the fact that it took 3 hours for him to resign, as opposed to this being a front page story for a week because he's hemming and hawing about it, is an interesting, thing to look at.
We're out of time. I'm going to take I get the last comment, which I almost never do. The Trump Republican Party talks about fake news and blames journalists for so many of the problems, not reporting accurately on what's happening. Eric Schneiderman, the Democratic Attorney General of New York, would not have stepped down within 3 hours were it not for one of the best journalists in the country, Jane Mayer, digging out this story and reporting it with such accuracy and depth of detail that Schneiderman had to run away from the office in hours because she got him on this one. So journalism is still an important part of what this country is all about, Greg Bluestein.
Amen.
Right. That's it. I promise. No more sermons from me for the rest of the month. Thank you, Eric Tannenblatt, Andra Gillespie, Julianne Thompson, Greg Bluestein. We're out of here. Hey, by tomorrow, by the way, tomorrow on Two-Way Street, we're revisiting a conversation with a great singer-songwriter, Jimmy Webb. By the time I get to Phoenix, Galveston, so many wonderful songs. So that's on it, too. I hope you join us for that and then come back Friday for another Political Rewind. Take care.